For some, Christ's invitation to believe and remain continues to be hard or difficult to accept. Some disciples struggle to understand a specific church policy or teaching. Others find concerns in our history or in the imperfections of some members and leaders, past and present. Still others find it difficult to live a religion that requires so much. Finally, some have become weary in well-doing. For these and other reasons, some church members vacillate in their faith.
This is Infants on Thrones, the philosophies of men mingled with humor. We are the Quorum.
Welcome back to Infants on Thrones. I'm your host, Heather, and today we're bringing you a discussion that Glenn and Randy and I had quite a while ago, back before the election when we were all innocent and free. The genesis of this discussion was interactions I had with Mormons who didn't know why people were leaving the church, but speculated that it must have been because of offenses. I got to thinking about where that standard narrative of people getting offended and leaving the church came from, and I realized that it's what's taught to them every 4 years in Sunday school when they study the Doctrine and Covenants. There's a lesson in the manual on apostasy, which leaves out all of the context of Joseph Smith's legal troubles, his failed revelations, the collapse of the church bank, the discovery of Joseph's secret relations with other women, and instead paints those who left the church over these issues as faithless squabblers obsessed over trivial personal offenses. So, if you're wondering what your TBM friends and family are taught about why you left the church, here it is, finally getting the smackdown it deserves. And the closer music is my favorite breakup song of all time, Superlative Bob. Just saying. Speaking of taking your Barbies and going home, that's what this episode is all about. The reason why petty, pouty, whiny exmos quit going to church, right?
You forgot angry.
Angry, yes. So for my opening, so this is lesson 24 from Doctrine and Covenants and Church History. And so my opening activity as the teacher is to write the following on the blackboard: a pint of cream, a misspelled name, and no available seating at the Kirtland Temple dedication. Then tell the class members that these phrases all have something in common. What could that be, Glenn?
They are all reasons given by early church members for their apostasy from the church.
Ooh, he's a historian. Wow. Glenn, you know so much.
Yes.
right. So these are the most petty, silly, and also contrived retellings of stories for why people left the church. Just to give you a flavor for how dismissive you can be of your friends and relatives who no longer believe the church is true. So now, spoiler alert, people leave because they no longer believe it's true.
So, but now's the point, Heather, where you need to explain that today's lesson discusses how to avoid individual apostasy.
These phrases and stories that go with them will be explained later in the lesson.
Yes.
All right, now. So, go ahead, Glenn, you want to do number one?
Discussion and application. Prayerfully select the lesson material that will best meet class members' needs. Discuss how the selected material applies to daily life. One, we should recognize...
This is the only leeway that they give the person giving the lesson.
You have your own agency.
Prayerfully select.
Yeah,
yes.
Prayerfully.
Right. You could prayerfully decide which parts of the lesson you want to emphasize, but give the lesson.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Oh, you know what? That's a good catch, because I totally misread that.
The verb is select.
Yeah, well, it's select the lesson material from this lesson. Like, I always thought that was like, or supplemental material from outside of the lesson manual. No, it's saying, of all of the shit that we've got printed down in here, pick this shit that you like best. Yeah.
Yeah, you were clearly reading your own instructions.
I was. I'm like,
you're bringing in outside sources.
Right, yeah, like Corinthians. Okay.
Was that 2 Corinthians?
There's no telestial.
There's no telestial. Okay, so it says, we should recognize the deceptions of Satan that can lead us into apostasy.
Explain. So let's poison the well. You're deceived by Satan.
Yeah. Explain that during the early years of the church, some members were deceived by Satan and led into apostasy or rebellion against God. A few members, yeah, I mean, rebellion against God isn't rebellion against Joseph Smith, you know, like Joseph Smith and prophecies that they believed in that didn't come true, that they're going, wait a minute, what's going on here?
Right.
Yeah. I had this in, so another thing that's recent for me is my last living grandparent, my grandfather, passed away last week, and so we had his funeral over the weekend. I saw a lot of family members that I haven't seen in years, cousins and uncles and aunts and stuff, and it was a very, you know, Mormon funeral, as Randy loves. But there was at one point some reference to Abraham 3, that the purpose of life is we will prove them herewith to see if they'll, you know, obey everything that God tells them. And it just, you know, like when so I come across things like this now, I'm like, well, brilliant move, Joseph Smith. That was so good as you're writing this pseudepigraphical scripture in Book of Abraham, make sure that everybody knows that the purpose of life, the purpose of every single person who's reading that's life, is to see if they will be obedient to everything that you say and will call it God. You know? So, like, I'm the only person that talks to God, everybody. I'm Joseph Smith. You follow me, and we're going to prove you if you'll follow, even when it seems hard or even when it seems like it doesn't make sense. And that's it. Like, oh.
That's what you call rigging the game.
Yeah.
Well, to rebel against great Joseph move. Is to rebel against God. It's a great.
It's the one sin that cannot be forgiven. What's it? Prediction?
Denying the Holy Ghost.
Denying the Holy Ghost, which is basically denying the testimony of Joseph Smith. Fighting against Joseph Smith is the worst possible sin. That you'll go to outer darkness for that one, but not for anything else.
Oh yeah.
Oh geez. Anyway.
Wait. Brigham Young said, this is one of my favorite quotes, if there's a despicable character on the face of the earth, it is an apostate from the church. He is a traitor who has deceived his best friends, betrayed his trust, and forfeited every principle of honor that God placed within him.
Yeah.
They may think they're respected, but they are not. They are disgraced in their own eyes. There's not much honesty within them. They have forfeited their heaven, sold their birthright, and betrayed their friends.
Do you feel so in your experience, Heather, when you were with your family this last week, did you feel, even as they're creating this narrative about the guy that they didn't really know anything about, did you feel like they were really that judgmental towards it? Like, did they really feel like he was this awful, despicable person in the Brigham Young sense?
I don't think so. And I don't think that they were judging him for it. In fact, other things that they said were quite understanding. It was just, I mean, they've heard this lesson so many times and in so many forms that when they're trying to explain a story that they don't have any facts about, the default is to say he was offended, because that's the reason that they're told people leave the church. People leave because they're offended. And yeah. So they had to create a narrative that fit that just based on what they're taught in church. That's what I think.
And they had this little seed that they could riff off of, that he had a stillborn child. So he had this, he had a tragedy. And,
oh, we should explain this story, right? So well, I was with my family.
Oh, yeah, I've got it from before. So I'll
use
it. Yeah.
Okay.
Unless you want to do it again, it's fine.
I just want to condense it. So we're a family in their ward. The father had left the church. I asked if they knew why. They said they had no idea, but then started inventing this story that my niece said, I think he got really hurt by someone in the church, and that's why he left. And then my sister said, I think what happened is they had this stillborn baby or this baby who died shortly after birth, and somebody in church must have said something trying to console him, well-meaning, like saying, oh, you know, it's such a blessing, or he's going straight to the celestial kingdom. And I think he got so offended by that that he had his records removed.
Yeah, and that's a big, that's a huge difference between someone who, and apparently they had some inside knowledge that he did have his name removed from the church. It's a big difference between that and just going inactive.
Right. Right.
Because they can, that shows like an intent that is strong enough to warrant them coming up with a story other than, you know, because like an easy default would be he just couldn't hack it and he didn't want to live the standards of the church. But yeah, they didn't go that way, because he made such a strong gesture by having his name removed. So then they had to kind of up their game of apologetics.
Right. I mean, the scariest explanation for why people leave the church is that they don't believe it's true. No Mormon wants to hear an anti-testimony that someone doesn't believe the church is true. They want to go every month and hear, I know without a shadow of a doubt, with every fiber of my being. And so when somebody has the confidence to actually take their names off the rolls, it usually isn't because they're offended. I mean, and I, you know, I'm coming up with this narrative now that it's that he probably left because he doesn't believe it's true, but that's just based on the statistics. 3 out of 4 people who leave the church say they do it because they don't believe that it's true.
Maybe their study?
Yeah, the survey of why people leave the church, 74% say that's why they go. 4% list an offense as being an important reason in why they left. 4% versus, you know, 74. So my default logic is, if you really are taking your names off the rolls, that's because, you know, taking your name off the books written in heaven, it's because you're darn sure that there is no book being written. All right, so that was my own coming up with a narrative.
Well, and it even amps it up to another level if it's someone that you previously respected. Like when I left the church, my closest friend in ortho school, the thing that he said to me was, you know, I've always revered you as such a valiant defender of the faith. And then for me to turn, to flip the tables on that to him was just so much more devastating than if it was somebody that, you know, he didn't really care about or respect. I was someone he respected and I was a defender of the faith, and he had seen my defense in action. And so I think that to me, that increases the level of cognitive dissonance when someone you respect says they don't believe.
Yeah, for sure.
And the way to relieve that dissonance is to find a flaw in the person. And I certainly have enough flaws, and I imagine that he's come up with, you know, he's been fed all these narratives all his life, and I imagine he's come up with a narrative, you know, that I basically was too prideful and too curious or something like that.
Right. Glenn, you want to finish that paragraph and then we'll skip?
All right. So this is, again, the instruction to a teacher. Explain that during the early years of the church, some members were deceived by Satan and led into apostasy or rebellion against God. A few members who apostatized became enemies of the church and contributed to the persecutions of the saints in Ohio and Missouri. As members of the church today, we must be faithful and watchful so we are not deceived.
What kills me in here is not what it is saying, but how much it's not saying. I mean, this is supposedly church history and DNC gospel doctrine manual, and it tells you nothing about why those people left the church. Just says, you know, they apostatized, they were deceived by Satan, gives you none of their rationale, none of the very legitimate, logical reasons why people concluded that Joseph Smith wasn't a prophet, you know, and says instead they just became enemies of the church. It's just so misleading. It gives no useful information.
Well, let's ask these questions of each other. Why does Satan want to deceive us, Glenn?
Because he's miserable, because he didn't get his way in heaven, and so he wants everybody else to be miserable too, and he just wants to promote misery.
Well, how does that help Satan?
Because he's upset with God, because God kicked him out, and it's like sour grapes, like the Aesop's fable, so he's trying to make the grapes sour for everybody else, because that'll show God. Like, because he knows that God loves all these people, us, and so Lucifer's going to take us away from God.
But hasn't Satan figured out that the whole plan rests on opposition in all things, and that in order for the plan of salvation to work, somebody has to be tempting them? So if he really wanted to screw God over, he could just sit the game out?
No, he hasn't read 2 Nephi chapter 2.
Okay.
No, but it's what he does. It's like one of those Geico commercials. If you're the devil, you tempt people. That's what you do.
We should have taken a left at the river.
Tarzan, no. Where Tarzan go?
Tarzan does not know where Tarzan go.
Me, Tarzan, king of jungle.
Why don't you want to?
If you're a couple, you fight over directions. It's what you do.
You know,
you're a scorpion. You're gonna stink.
Yeah,
you're a crab. You're crab in the bucket. You're gonna grab as many other crabs that are trying to climb out of the bucket as you can. All right, so Heather, are some of the ways?
But wait, I've got even better answers to this. You're going to go away from me so quickly? You're bored?
No. I didn't know you had more.
Yeah, Satan.
Gosh, put your hand higher in the air.
What does Satan want? Huh?
Satan want to be miserable like
Satan
him.
Satan wants to be the god of this world, and that's what he became. He became the god of this world when he introduced the fruit of the tree to Adam and Eve instead of Jehovah doing that, because Lucifer had seen that in other plans that the Jehovah figure was the one who introduced Adam and Eve into the garden, and they got the commandment, don't partake of the fruit. But it was a probationary commandment, you know, because God usually gives commandments, and then he says, okay, now you can do what I told you before not to. I was just testing you, but now it's okay to do it. And so Satan stepped in and gave them the fruit because he was trying to usurp Jesus's or Jehovah's position, and that made him the god of this world. And so because Satan did that, God cursed him.
Brother Osland, I don't like you referring to Satan as a god of anything. He is not a deity, and I think you're being very irreverent and that you're blaspheming right now, and I'm worried for your soul.
Then you're not paying attention in the temple when he is the god of this world, and he goes, now is the great day of my power, right?
No, well, he says that you believe him.
It doesn't mean you're the god of this world.
I'm saying that's his motivation. That's what he wants. And it is, I think it is LDS doctrine that Satan is the god of this world because he introduced people into he introduced the sin, and so the role of the atonement is for God to save this world from Lucifer's grasp.
Well, first of all, Lucifer being the god, first of all, his name isn't Lucifer. Satan being the god of this world is the first I'm hearing of it from Glenn. And also, Glenn, seriously, you are getting a Mormon accent thicker just since the time that you've moved to Arizona.
Yeah.
I can hear it. Uh-huh. I can hear it.
Hear it?
It. Yeah, like Holland. If you don't do it,
do it.
You're going to get it.
You can get it. All right. Yes.
Okay.
So Satan wanted to be the god of this world. And,
yeah.
I mean, because if he really wanted to fuck God over, he could have not tempted them at all, and then they'd still be in the garden today.
No, that's not true, because eventually, God would have said, okay, you can enter mortality now. You've kept your second estate, and so now I'm going to introduce you into the next one. And Jehovah's the one that's supposed to do that. This isn't the first time this has happened, Randy. This isn't the first plan. It's eternal. And it was always...
When Satan... Yeah. When Satan says, I'm doing what has been done in other worlds, he doesn't say, I'm doing what Jehovah has done in other worlds. How do you know it wasn't a Satan figure doing what was done in other worlds before?
Because
that's a bit of a leap.
Because Elohim's response is, well, because you've done this, you're going to be cursed. And Lucifer says, well, if you curse me for doing what's been done in other worlds, then I'm going to take the spirits that follow me, you know. And it's escalating the conflict. So he's deviated from the plan somehow. He thought that by doing this, he was going to thwart God's plan because he was going to introduce sin and death together instead of just introducing death. But it didn't, because
there
was a plan
B.
Because God foresees it, and he had a plan B prepared. Just like the small plates of Nephi, he had a plan B. He knew the 116 pages were going to be lost, but he prepared in advance. And, you know, you can't thwart God, you guys. You just can't.
But what if it's...
He won't allow it.
What if plan A is to always what if plan A is to always piss off somebody in heaven enough to turn them into the devil? What if that's always the necessary thing? Is that you thrust down the son of the morning?
But it isn't. It's just
because you said it not.
Right. Yeah. Because it isn't.
Okay.
No,
you got a compelling story there. I like it.
But what if? Because if it was, then it wouldn't be fair. But we know that God's fair, so it can't be.
Okay. That's brilliant logic.
It is. It works.
Mm-hmm. Because God has never done anything unfair.
No. God is yeah. fair, and he loves everyone, and everything he does is motivated by love.
Okay, well, speaking of being unfair, what bothers me so much about this infant child thing, and has always bothered me, and I've been the Hermione Granger raising my hand in Sunday school to ask this challenging question, is, so we know infant baptism is wrong, that it's unfair for kids who die before they're baptized to be thrust down to hell. But Joseph Smith's response to the injustice of unbaptized infants going to hell is to create the injustice of everyone who dies before the age of accountability gets a free pass to the highest level of the celestial kingdom. And I also checked on that today, and that's, you know, Bruce R. McConkie had a wonderful explicit talk about quoting Joseph Fielding Smith and Joseph Smith and DNC, I can't remember which section, saying for sure 100% everybody who dies before the age of accountability plus those who are disabled so that they're considered children all go straight to the highest level of the celestial kingdom. So how is that fair? And also, doesn't it create the perverse incentive that if you really loved your children and wanted what's best for them, shouldn't you kill them all before the age of 8 so you can send them straight to the celestial kingdom? Instead of risking.
That's what a woman in Texas did.
Yeah, exactly. People have done
five
that.
She drowned all five of her kids.
She wasn't Mormon.
But she still believed that it was the same belief, strain of thought, was that she was so sure that this evil world, and she was mentally insane. I mean, she had psychological
schizophrenia.
Problems. Yeah, but religion like fed, like gave a narrative for her schizophrenia. And she was so certain that the world was going to tempt her kids into sinning and going to hell that she decided to kill them in their innocence. And she's actually, I really wanted to hate her, but watching a couple documentaries on her, she really is just a sick person, you know, that didn't get the help she needed and had a horrible narrative fed to her that just, it was like gasoline and fire. But the evolution of this doctrine is, first of all, Mormonism is a Protestant religion. It's not, you know, its roots are separate from Catholicism. And so since they didn't believe in infant baptism, and infant mortality was so much higher in the 19th century, a lot of members, especially mothers, were really concerned about their children's welfare. And so Joseph Smith just feeds them something that they, that would be really comforting to them. And how could that not be comforting to them? But then he's not thinking about second, third level, you know, implications to this kind of doctrine. When you think about it, if somebody had killed Hitler when he was a baby, he'd be in the, he'd, you know, for sure go to the Celestial Kingdom.
And I knew somebody was going to bring up infant Hitlers.
He's the quintessential example of like.
But seriously,
50 million people died. 60 million people died because of him.
Yeah, but not because of baby Hitler.
If he
would have died as a baby, he wouldn't have been the Hitler that you know and hate and love to use as an example for things.
But he did, and how is that fair? If all these babies that die get a free pass, of course. I also have heard Heather the doctrine that all in, and I don't know how people have come up with this doctrine, but I've heard the doctrine that all people who died before the age of accountability will be raised and tried just like the rest of us during the millennium. The millennium is like the catch-all in Mormonism.
Oh, let me respond in the words of Bruce R. McConkie. Sorry.
Okay. Go ahead.
So Bruce R. McConkie says to that, will children ever be tested? Absolutely not. Any idea that they will be tested in paradise or during the millennium or after the millennium is pure fantasy. Why would a resurrected being who's already come forth from the grave with a celestial body and whose salvation is guaranteed be tested, Randall?
I'm so stupid. But that's what I was taught. And that's funny.
Of course you were.
Absolutely contradict, because what I was taught makes more sense. But right. Bruce is sticking, he's a hardliner, and he's sticking to the King Follett discourse and then following logically, you know, the algorithm of Mormonism and Mormon doctrine. It is said, so it shall be done. If you die as an infant, you will go straight to the celestial kingdom. No ifs, ands, or buts. But I think later Mormons have found that to be unfair and not really logical. So they've come up with the things that I was taught, which is that they'll be raised during the millennium and be tested there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they're faced with this total paradox that mortality is all about being tested and we all need to come here to get a body and be tested, and this crazy doctrine that there's a loophole that if the child dies before the age of accountability, no testee for you, straight to the gold star standard level, right? So they're trying to come up with some way to make God fair, because as Glenn was saying, if he were ceased to be fair, then he would cease to be God, and this just ain't fair. So one of the doctrines that I've, and explanations that I've heard, is they must have been so valiant in the pre-existence that they somehow passed the test before the exam started. And so that's why they're given the free pass.
Kind of like black people. They were the slackers of class in the pre-existence. And that's why they were born black.
But all right, now you're faced with another conundrum, because in another one of the sections of the Bruce R. McConkie talk is, well, you mean children of every race? And the answer is yes, all children, every race. So he's trying to have it both ways here. The fence sitters who die before eight are still going to the highest level of the celestial kingdom. I mean, it's a tangled web.
But there was never in the racist LDS approach to blacks, it was never that they couldn't get into the celestial kingdom. It was just that they wouldn't hold the priesthood or have the temple ordinances. So they're at least being internally consistent with their logic that any kid under the age of eight, God's given them a pass, no matter what the color of their skin or what race they're born into.
Oh, I guess I'm saying the paradox is either they were the fence sitters or they were so righteous that they deserved the free pass.
Yeah, so they're born black as a fence sitter, but they die when they're two.
Yeah.
Which is it? Which were they in the pre-existence, Glenn?
They were a fence sitter.
They were a fence sitting badass?
Uh-huh.
Then why do they get to go straight to the celestial kingdom? Because, how's that fair?
Because God knew them. God knew them. God knows. You just got to trust in God. Don't.
Then why?
Are you God, Heather? Are you God, Randy?
Very good. Very good. Oh, are now you God?
Are you God?
Were you there?
Were you there?
But then, all right, so let's follow that logic, Glenn. So if God knew them, why did he send any of us?
Because we needed to get the bodies.
All right, so why didn't we all die 2 seconds after birth?
That's what Lucifer wanted. That's why he rebelled. He's like, God, the real question is, why did he give us a veil of forgetfulness? Why? That doesn't make any sense. If you want people to come back, just don't wipe their memory. Give them the body and let them come back.
No, because of faith, dude. Faith.
Yeah.
But faith, you gotta read the subtle signs.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know the answer to all things, but I know that the Lord loveth his children.
Right. And there's like some scripture in Alma that my dad was like the biggest cop-out scripture. You know, the I do not know the meaning of all things. Is that what you were quoting? That might have been what you were quoting.
Pretty sure it's Nephi.
Oh, his was Alma. It's like, therefore I shall forbear.
Now these mysteries are not yet fully made known unto me, therefore I shall forbear.
You know, like, okay. All things have not been revealed to me, therefore I shall be forbear. Right. And it's like, that was his go-to for everything. Like, Dad, stop it!
That's a non-starter. That's a conversation stopper.
But, you know, but here's
if it doesn't make sense, I'm not going to talk about it. We just
trust in God.
Just go on faith.
You just trust that he knows what's going on. And when he takes somebody, even if they're black, that he's got a really good reason for it.
At least he's not, you're not saying like FARC.
American FARC.
American FARC. American FARC.
When go swimming in the creek.
Yeah. And then jump on the roof.
On the roof. All right. And then go hunting wolves.
And right by the creek.
Yep. And I was barn in a born. Washing the corn. Carn. Washing the corn.
Carn.
Malking the cows.
All right.
Well, where'd we go with that?
But here's the thing. We're coming up with all of these questions, and we're doing it from just academic perspective, just kind of testing the arguments. But there was a guy, a family, who lost a baby and who has to deal with all of these questions and try to understand all of the answers that the church has given and make sense of it. And, you know, it's possible that in so doing, he recognized that some of the answers that the church gives to the big questions don't hold up or contradict each other or don't make sense or are just really unsatisfying to those who are mourning.
Yep. But, you know, if you don't think about them too much, they're fine. And that's why when you go to the average Mormon funeral is not weeping and wailing and renting your sackcloth. The average Mormon funeral, to me, I find creepily, like, not dealing with the tragedy at hand. So they work. It's just like with everything with Mormon doctrine, it just doesn't work when you take it to the second, third, or fourth level. And that's where all the contradictions come in and the unsatisfactory feelings come in when you think about them a lot. But a lot of people just don't want to think about it, you know?
Right.
But I want to ask this question. It's in the manual here, and I want to ask Glenn this question. What are some of the ways in which Satan tries to deceive us and lead us into apostasy?
Well, I think one of the first things is he tries to make us think that we're smarter than our leaders.
Yeah.
Like that we know better than our leaders do.
Mm-hmm.
Because to be learned is good as long as you hearken. Or woe unto the learned. When they are learned, they think they are wise.
Yeah.
And their wisdom profiteth them nothing, and they shall perish.
Right.
Very good.
Right. They're not humble, and they harden their hearts. Like, Satan knows that he's able to get them to harden their hearts to hearing the subtle promptings of the Spirit. And the still small voice. It's still small. You know, I've been gone for a while. It's still small, that voice.
I'm reminded of Oakes's comment in that PBS documentary.
Oh, right, about criticism.
Yeah, like people are expected to follow the leaders even when they're wrong.
Yeah, it's never okay to criticize the brother. Never.
Right. And he said it with like a wry smile, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
Even if they're wrong. Yeah, so, and this was the narrative for my older brother for the longest time, is he's too smart for his own good, and him and his wife are just too smart for their own good. And that scripture in 2 Nephi I had highlighted, and I wrote Jim and Heather's name in the margins. I still have that book. The wisdom of men, pride. What, and anything else, Heather? What are some other ways Satan leads us astray?
Right. So, what else? I'm skipping down.
Well, because people want to sin, so he makes like. There's a fine line, Randy, between happiness and joy, and like one of them's really good and the other one's really bad, and I don't remember which one. I think like happiness is eternal, but joy is fleeting. Joy is just for the moment, probably because happiness is a longer word. It has more letters and more consonants, and joy is just like boop, joy, you know.
I've always heard
pleasure.
The delineation was pleasure.
Yeah,
yeah. Joy and happiness are long lasting, and pleasure is fleeting.
Okay.
Because the joy stands for Jesus, then others, then yourself.
If you put
Jesus first, then others, and yourself last, then you will have joy.
Not only that, men are that they might have joy.
Right. And happiness.
Because she's hot.
And joy's a total 10.
Yeah. Happiness has penis in it. So.
And you use that to your advantage.
Whereas pleasure does not.
Yeah, it's just got.
Well, pleasure is about pleasing her, and that's boring.
Yeah, right. But then it wouldn't be fleeting. Anyway,
but mostly being offended. That's how Satan tempts us, just by getting offended.
Well, he gets people lazy. You know, like he gets people to start taking shortcuts and being lazy. And find, you know, instead of like enduring to the end for real joy / happiness, they take shortcuts for things that are counterfeit to that bring like short term pleasure or pleasure. If I'm gonna do the
pleasure.
Western set, it's pleasure.
Pleasure.
Mm-hmm. Pleasure your pleasure.
Yeah.
It's a treasure.
Is it Pleasant Grove instead of Pleasant Grove? Yeah. Pleasant Grove.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, were we right, Randy? Are those the right right answers to the question?
Yeah, I mean, I would be dishonest if I didn't admit that not having to do home teaching or collect home teaching numbers and all of the things that I just found as petty, busy work wasn't a relief when I didn't believe.
Right.
So, I mean, it's not like. I'm not gonna take a disingenuous position that I didn't want to sin, because I did want to sin. According to Mormons, I wanted to drink. I wanted to not do my fucking home teaching. I wanted to stop the self-defeating, you know, just impractical practice of having the children read out of the scriptures and pretend that this is fun and enjoyable and uplifting when it was always a nightmare. If I'm totally honest, that the
you let Satan get to you.
Yeah, totally. No, I mean, it was
you willingly
it was
went with
party,
him.
It was a party bonus.
Yeah,
but
right, it might have been
at the
a
same
factor.
Time, it was probably a factor, but at the same time. The social costs were so high. I was so afraid of losing my faith. I was so afraid of what the neighbors would think. I'd built social capital over several years in my ward, and I was afraid that they would think less of me. So there was a lot of pressure to try to make it work, but in the end, it just didn't work.
So Randy, did it come as a relief to you at all when you realized that they couldn't possibly have thought any less of you? Like, did that make you feel better or worse?
I moved pretty quickly after I left the church.
Okay.
In the ward that I left the church, where I was the high priest group leader and in the young men's presidency. But I do remember when I came out to the bishop and he like took my temple recommend on the spot, and he released me on the spot from the young men's presidency, afterwards, I felt kind of like, oh, you know what? I do want to try to make this work a little bit. And I called the young men's president and I said, hey, you know, I'm willing to stay on in your presidency until you can find a replacement. And he's like, no, that's okay.
Wow.
He did not want to have anything to do with me.
That's painful, because I was about to say, you know, you could drink, you could stop reading scriptures with the kids, you could stop doing your home teaching and still go to church and not take your name off the records. I mean, that's always the fallacy, is that you have to leave the church in order to sin, which is not true. Unlike most of the people you know are sinning in some way, right?
I guess no, all of them. That's the difference between the Jack Mormon and the apostate.
Right.
Jack Mormon is something they can understand, but the apostate is something that they don't want to even entertain.
Right.
What did you ask just before?
I was just thinking, you know, for me, I didn't want to drink. I didn't want to, I wasn't a faithful visiting teacher, but I kind of loved the people that I was working with and would have been fine doing it. And, you know, I read my scriptures every day and didn't find it to be a big hardship. So that wasn't a big factor for me. If I thought there was a 1% chance of the church being true, I would still probably be, I would be there every week and doing the whole nine yards. You know, if I thought it could be true, I would do it, just because I've been indoctrinated for so long that it's such a huge risk, that the stakes are so high that you would be throwing away the most important and wonderful thing that you can even imagine, eternal exaltation, except, you know, women's exaltation is just to disappear. But I'd still be there. I'd still be doing the full Mormon thing if I thought it could be true.
You weren't excited about being the non-existent Heavenly Mother?
Oh, I just listened to I forget her name. Who just wrote that thing, the book on polygamy, the Ghost of
Pearson.
Eternal Polygamy. I just listened to her talking on a podcast. Gosh, polygamy is so effed up.
Yeah, it's Carolyn Pearson.
We have to do some kind of episode on polygamy again. I'm sorry, we're getting off the rails here, though. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Well, No, I found it really interesting what you said, Heather, if there was even a 1% chance of the church being true. And it just made me wonder, and this is probably a topic for a different discussion, but what does it mean for the church to be true? Because if you still believed, like, that November policy that came through was so horrible, but if you believed that really is coming from Jesus Christ, and, like, does that mean that the church is true? Or would you ever get to a point where you're like, yeah, Jesus Christ or God, they're evil. They're not, they exclude people, and I don't, like, we don't share the same values, me and God. So you could say the values of the LDS Church and list out what all the values are and say, okay, there's some really good things here, there's some really damaging things in here, and at some point it crosses over to net negative for you. But, like, the church could still be true but not be good, I guess.
Right, that God is not a God worthy of worship. Yeah. I don't think many people actually come to that conclusion, and I think the main reason why is that the epistemology, how you know something is true within the church, is that it gives you the warm and cozy feeling, right? And you have the testimony of that. And when the policy is so offensive to every fiber of your being, then that is, in its way, a testimony that this isn't true. It's not an independent, for a lot of people, for the people who take it seriously, it's not an independent phenomenon that there's just a wrong and an offensive policy within the church. The fact that there's a wrong and offensive policy within the church tells them that the way that they know whether something is true or not has some kind of flaw in it.
But don't you think there are groups of people like Rock Waterman, probably New Order Mormons, I don't know much about the Snufferites, but that they believe the Joseph Smith part of the church. You know, they believe in the Restoration, they believe that narrative, but feel like the modern church, the corporate church, has gone into some apostasy. And, you know, so in that case, is there a 1% chance that the church is true? That, you know, they would say, well, it was and it's got off track and we need to get it back on track, kind of thing.
Oh, absolutely. You know what? That's a really good point. Yeah, I didn't even think of that. Yeah, for sure. And that's why all religions are constantly splintering, and there's always heretics and new factions within churches popping up, because at some point someone always says, "Hey, we've gotten away from what this originally was."
And I think the warm fuzzies that are kind of doing it. You know, it's like, what are you comfortable with in among the teachings and among the doctrines? And as soon as there's things that you're not comfortable with, then you know, I'm wondering out loud, then that starts making you question if it's true or not. But it's not really, you're not really wondering if it's true. You're just wondering if you're compatible with it. But we're framing it in the language of it being true. And, you know, like 1% chance of it being true, it just, like, if there was anything remotely valuable to you, or is that what you're saying? Or you're saying true? You know. Anyway, I'm.
No, it's not valuable. It's not the value. It's if I believed that there was a significant probability that the Book of Mormon was a real testament, another testament of Jesus Christ, and that Joseph Smith was a prophet of the Restoration. If I believed that there was a chance that the Book of Abraham was an ancient record, you know, if I believed that there was a 1% chance that those things were true, that the Restoration was real, then I'd still go to church. But to answer your question about, so the way that the LDS Church answers that question of, so you feel some kind of dissonance between where the church is now, or the good feelings that you have about the church, and the things that the policies or practices or issues with the church that you don't have good feelings about, is this very first reason they give for why people leave the church, which is not recognizing the prophet as the sole source of revelation for the church, that it's immediate appeal to authority. There's only one person who knows, and that is the president of the church. And then the story that they give about it is when Hiram Page had a stone and he was receiving revelations from it, and the prophet prayed about it and received the revelation that no, there's only one person, and it's the president of the church who has the right to receive revelations for the church. So no matter what you may be feeling about things, it's the president of the church.
Well, and I also think that, like, you were holding on to the end of last year to just some kind of sliver of decency to make yourself compatible with still being active, because you were so plugged in socially through the church. And then that November thing was almost like the last straw. Like, there was no decency left in the church for you to hold on to anymore. Is that accurate?
So by that time, I didn't think there was a 1% chance. By that time, I felt like I, without having certainty, right, I knew that the church, I felt, you know, without having certainty, that I had actionable intelligence that the church was not true, that it was not incumbent upon me to go to church, and that it was not, that my eternal salvation was not at stake. However, I still wanted to go because of the value that I saw in the church, which is what Glenn is talking about. And then, you know, I was continually reevaluating that. Is the value that I see in the church worth the cost? And I, you know, I'm at the point that I don't, that it just isn't to me. It isn't. As much as I do see value in the church, and we can do another episode on that, it's not enough.
How much of their actions over the last year played into that final decision that the value isn't worth the damage or the bad?
Well,
because the female stuff has always been there.
Has always been there, and that's right. You know, I knew that I wasn't going to raise my kids in the church forever. I definitely felt that. The question was just, how long do we stay and how do we leave and that kind of thing. And that really, in the end, ended up being my husband's decision, because there was a point at which he said, I'm not going to go anymore and I'm not going to take the kids. You know, he was willing to maybe take them once a month if I really insisted upon it. But at that point, I thought, you know, why would I be separating my family on Sundays to do something that I don't actually believe in? So at that point, the value of going no longer outweighed. And the fact that I was so, that it was so clear that the direction that the church is going in is further away from everything that I hold dear, just made it easier to walk.
And you said something in there that I've been thinking about through this whole tangent that we're on right now, about the eternal salvation, you know, like saving your soul, that once the church loses you there, you know, that you no longer are reliant on the church and the priesthood for the ordinances necessary for salvation, because that belief's gone. To me, that, in my experience, that was the biggest shift to detaching from the church. And then there were all these other little things that I was hanging on to at different, but that really was the core of it to me. So if I'm trying to understand like what I would be meaning if I was saying the church is true, it's probably that truth claim about priesthood and ordinances and these things that you have to do or you're screwed forever, you know?
Right.
And once that went away, it's just like, and so I think that's consistent with what they're saying in this manual, that if you don't, if you no longer have that reverence and, you know, just deferring to the leaders in all things and, you know, the obedience, you just accept it, you know, that is the first step to going apostate. So I think that,
yeah, and that holds so much psychological sway over you. If your entire childhood, during your most impressionable years, you've been told this horrific fairy tale that if you, as a Mormon who is privileged to be born into the one true church, should ever leave it, that you'll be cast into outer darkness and there'll be weeping and wailing and gnashing of teeth and fire and molten sulfur for the endless eternities to come. I mean, that holds a lot of psychological power over you, and it really is a complete paradigm shift when you realize the reason that I'm so afraid of that is that people whose authority and position depends on me believing it have been telling me that my whole life.
Yeah, and then they add this extra pressure of the mantra, where much is given, much is required. And we're all taught how much we've been given. And in really the cosmic sense, we have been given a lot. We're all white. We were born middle-class America. And we all had access to education. But that's the Mormon narrative is that you were valiant and righteous in the pre-existence to be Mormon. And if you waste that, your suffering is going to be even greater than if you had never known the Mormon Church at all, or even Jesus. If you'd been better if you were born in Calcutta. And so they add that pressure onto the psyche of the Mormon, which makes them not want to have to deal with it makes them not very curious when they find out that their sister or their brother doesn't believe anymore. It's just that they want to take the path of least resistance, as we all do, you know.
Right.
It's just human nature. Why upset the apple cart of my whole worldview by entertaining these questions when they, you know, I've been told my entire life how dangerous and miserable that path is.
Mm-hmm.
And so what am I left to do? Well, I got to find a fault with my brother or my sister who has told me that they don't believe anymore.
Right. Or think that they actually do believe. Hold on to this hope that they still believe that the church is true, but that they just really want to sin, or they're just too proud to continue to go to church after somebody offended them. Anything but believe that. Because if they're told all the time that leaving the church is the worst thing a person could ever do, and they'll be thrust to outer darkness, you know, horrible thing to do. And then they see people that they know and care about leaving the church. they must think they're like, it's that you must think I'm so stupid. Like, I sometimes want to say to my kids, you must think I'm stupid, right? If you think that I've left the church just because I wanted to, I don't know, wear sleeveless shirts or some ridiculous thing, or the milk strippings, whatever pint of cream story is. Like, if you really think that's why I left the church, then you don't know me at all.
Well, that is something that's been used on me once before. Is
really
the denial? No, the denial that you don't believe. I mean, this woman. She's a woman now. She's my age. She's in her 40s. But she was a girl, and I knew her growing up in the church. And I just made a post on Facebook that actually was a socioeconomic political comment, and she just attacked me like, you know, like a banshee, and just started clawing at my eyes, and like her last statement was in all caps, and she bore her testimony, you know, and finished it with, "And you know it too." You know? She's telling me what I believe. So that's another
tactic. Always goes over well.
That's another tactic is to relieve the cognitive dissonance is to say that you really do believe, but you're just lying.
Well, and it's part of the script, because that's in the Book of Mormon. You know, the Nehors and the Korahors that. You know, they knew all along that what they were preaching was false, but they were just having too much fun being popular and priestcrafty and all that stuff, right?
Yeah, each one of the atheists, all in the end, in that repeat narrative, all admitted they knew the Nephite church was true.
Yeah,
and, that's and very convenient.
Alma the Younger and the Sons of Mosiah, they all knew even when they were in rebellion, and you know, they turned it around, and good on them.
Right.
You know, it's part of the narrative.
Yeah.
Well, that makes it a whole lot easier on people who want to believe that you don't. I mean, that you do.
Yeah. So they're either going to say you were, give you some petty excuse, like you're offended, or they just won't believe that you don't believe.
Right. Right. Well, didn't you get this as part of your missionary training, though, when you're going through the commitment pattern and you're helping people feel and recognize the Spirit, and it's you tell them what they're feeling right then. You tell, like,
oh,
what
you're
feeling right now is the
Hope
Spirit.
Hofarts.
What?
It's called Hofarts. Helping others feel and recognize the Spirit.
Okay. We called it Hofers because there's no T at the end.
Farst.
And we weren't so puerile.
Puerile.
Childish.
Okay.
Adolescent.
Soft.
Infantile, yeah. Even.
Infantile.
Infantile, just like we are. Yeah, because
you
would
make infant
others.
Tiles and sell them next year at Sunstone. Tiles for your bathroom. They're infant. Tiles.
Infant tiles.
Never mind.
Nice
you
pun.
Love a good pun.
Nice pun. Fantastic. Yeah, so it's not only feel but recognize. So you're just trying to get them to have a good feeling, and you'll take any feeling as a good feeling as a missionary, wouldn't you?
Oh, sure.
Like anything. Like, are you feeling okay? Well, that's the Spirit. You're not feeling bad, right? Well. That means you're feeling good. That's a Spirit.
Yeah. But
you're ever feeling bad, it's because Satan's trying to deceive you.
Well, one of the things that was really fun for me, one of the first things I did with Mormon Expression, because I was living in Japan at the time, I went and I tracked down a guy that I baptized that was still active, and he was in the bishopric. And I just sat down and I interviewed him, and he reminded me of a time when I was his missionary and teaching him, and he didn't want to pray, and I was forcing him to pray, and I said something to him that was exactly what we're talking about here, like where I'm telling him, what you're feeling right now is the Spirit. And he's like, that freaked me out.
Ugh.
He's like, he goes, you were so, like, I don't know what the right word is, but just like confident, unyielding, you know, it was just so arrogant. to tell to be like, this is what you're doing right now. This is what God wants you to do. Do it. Just break through. Just do it. You know, like, anyway. So
he told you that, like,
in the interview. Yeah, we both had a good laugh about it.
Wow. He told you that in the interview. But he was still getting interviewed to get baptized. He got baptized.
Oh, he got baptized. Yeah, and he got baptized for the love of a woman. He got serious, and yeah, he's still married to her. They've got kids, and you know, all kinds of stuff. But yeah, he's a good guy, and he believes. He questions some things as well, but yeah, he's had a good life as a result of it. So I'm happy for him for that. But he
did
shared
you ever,
that with sorry. Me. That oh, go ahead.
Did you ever get together with all the missionaries in your district with an investigator who was struggling and have them like kneel in the middle of the circle and you all kneel in a circle around them and pray at the same time for them to receive a witness?
That sounds so creepy. No, you did that?
No.
Yeah. Talk about high pressure, peer pressure. I mean, looking back on it now, it kind of makes you throw up a little bit because of course people are going to have a feeling. I mean, we all have such powerful reptilian and mammalian instincts of herd animals where whether we realize it or not, we're paying attention to the breathing of those people around us, which is why it's so much scarier to watch a horror movie in the theater with all those other people who stop breathing at the same time that you do when they know there's going to be a freak out moment. But we don't think about that when we're giving each other these shared spiritual experiences with the same kind of breath recognition and all of that. Instead, it's just, oh, we're all feeling the spirit together. It's undeniable.
I just remember a lot being disappointed in the discussions when I would ask how they felt when they read I don't know, something, you know, it's a fifth discussion.
Right.
A passage in Malachi about tithing. Treasure. Yeah. And so how did you feel?
How did you feel about
that? And they're like, they would, you know, most of the time the answer was, I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, I was just reading what you told me to read and just being, you know, just struggling to find some way to convince them that they felt the spirit at that time.
But at least you believed them, because when they would tell me that they didn't, I would think that they were intentionally being rebellious, that they were like struggling against allowing the seed of God to be planted in their soul, you know, and that I had to go in and just like force it in. You know, like, no, this is what you're feeling. You are feeling it. Don't tell me that you're not.
Yeah, well, we're different personality types.
Yeah. Oh, boy.
I was a dick in different ways.
Yeah. Yeah.
And make no mistake, I was an insufferable dick.
Yeah. No one had any doubt.
No one. I don't have to convince anybody.
But Glenn, you do kind of like to torture people. That whole peanut butter date thing, making people dig through, that's just rude. You like to make people suffer and squirm.
Yeah, it's entertaining to me.
You know, I would think that after 170 years, how long has it been since the Marsh story, that they'd have a different story by now. I mean, they tell the same story every 4 years. And it hasn't changed in 2016. It's always Marsh.
Why would they need a new one? It's so effective.
Because they start, you know, if you've been a member for your whole life, you're like, oh, okay, here comes the Marsh thing again.
Yeah. Reinforce it so that anytime there's anybody that's offending you for anything, you can go, oh, this is just like the Marsh story, that you can minimize it right away. This isn't really a problem. These are milk strippings, blah, blah, blah. I don't really have to deal with it. Turn it off like a light switch.
So you're saying it's an effective way to create a shorthand.
It's an incredibly effective straw man.
Yeah.
That endures. And they don't need to create new straw men because this one does the job perfectly.
Well, what pisses me off so much about it is that it's not why Thomas Marsh left the church.
Yeah, I mean, it was about Danites, wasn't it?
It was the Danites, right, and yeah. The looting and their attack on, what was it, the settlement in Far West, right, in Davies County, and they were burning the non-Mormon settlements. And he, when he was excommunicated and in absentia, he even after the milk and strippings thing, he stayed in the church. He didn't leave until after this Danites attack. And then his statement about why he left it was that it was like these 80 Mormons were looting and burning things, and I didn't want to be a part of that.
And the milk stripping story wasn't something that was created until Utah, right?
Is that right? I didn't know that.
Yeah, I think it was just like a lot of the stories, like when the story of Brigham Young transfiguring into Joseph Smith, like every account of that is like 30 years later, and like there's zero people that went home and wrote in their journals that happened. I think this milk stripping story was something that was fabricated like in 1860. And then when Thomas Marsh came back to Utah because his life had turned to shit, Brigham Young did not take kindly to him coming back and publicly ridiculed him. But the milk strippings thing is something that was created after the fact to vilify someone that they saw as just the absolute traitor. To go and testify to Missouri about what the Mormons were doing with the Danites, that's like an unforgivable sin. So they had to come up with a story that would marginalize him and make him look trivial, make his complaints look silly. But I think we have transcripts of what he testified to the Missourian, to the governor about, right? This is where we need John Hamer.
Yeah, he would put this concisely and probably word for word, but I think we got the basics.
Yeah. I'm pretty confident in that this milk strippings thing was something that was created in Utah after the fact. After this recording, I'm going to go research it.
And make an insert.
And make an insert if I have to.
All right, so where have we gotten to?
We haven't gotten anywhere, so I'm starting to give up on the reading and smackdowning thing. Because we pretty much covered all these things.
Well, let's just list them then. So, not recognizing the prophet, we went over that. Pride, and that's the Marsh story, which is one woman was stealing the cream, and then her husband, and then it was sent to court, and her husband upheld. What was it? I don't even remember.
Well, they were fighting against the communistic society that God had restored to them. They were being capitalists.
Uh-huh.
And they got upset because they were supposed to be communists, socialists, you know?
Uh-huh.
And if you believe the prophet, the one true prophet, Monson, and his recounting of the story, home teachers got involved, which didn't exist back then.
Home teachers got involved?
Yes.
Oh, that's nice.
I'm 100% certain that he said that, home teachers got involved.
That's a nice anachronism.
Yep.
All right, so Sister Marsh was the one stealing the cream. Then the bishop said she'd broken the agreement. And then she and her husband got offended and left, right?
Well, yeah, she basically said that... Or the accusation of Sister Marsh was that she stripped a pint of cream for each cow and sent Sister Harris the milk without those pints of cream. So Sister Harris was complaining that she was being shorted of the full quality of the milk that she was supposed to get. And it was referred to the bishop. And when he determined Sister Marsh had violated her agreement by taking a pint of cream from each one of the cows, she and her husband were upset and appealed the matter to the High Council and then the First Presidency. Each council approved the original decision that Sister Marsh had been in error, so Thomas Marsh was pissed.
And it declared, says that?
No, I'm editorializing. Thomas B. Marsh declared that he was sustaining the character of his wife. Apparently, he denied that his wife had stolen a pint of cream from each cow. Soon afterward, he turned against the church and went before a government official to declare that Latter-day Saints were hostile towards the state of Missouri. So it's kind of true statement that he went before a government official to declare that Latter-day Saints were hostile towards the state of Missouri because he was kind of freaked out.
Because they were?
Yeah, by the... And I think he was also freaked out by Sidney Rigdon's famous talk, The Salt of the Earth. Do you remember that talk, Glenn?
Yeah, the Salt Sermon. Yeah,
the Salt Sermon. Yeah, yeah. Where it was like a bloodthirsty revenge sermon. So there was that rhetoric, and then the actions of the Danites raiding Missouri settlements, which led him to testify to the state of Missouri. This milk strippings thing was created after the fact. In fact, if we actually just follow this link, Journal of Discourses will probably have a date because it's testified by George A. Smith in the Journal of Discourses, which were, I think, all of the Journal of Discourses are from the state of Utah.
You know, the other thing that I'm remembering as you recite that milk stripping story, it's pretty insidious because the sin of Thomas B. Marsh that led him out of the church was standing up for his wife. So in this dispute where his wife's on one side and the church is on the other, instead of falling in line with the church, he falls in line with his wife. And, you know, guys, beware. You know, I remember this being like an undertone of the story.
That, right, that guys, your wife drag you down.
Yeah, if you're too blindly loyal to these petty women who get involved in petty disputes like over things like milk strippings, don't allow yourself to be torn down, you know, just because, like, I remember that very anti-female sentiment being taught or coming to, at least to me.
And you get the same thing with Martin Harris's wife. It's like, she's the same kind of character.
She's the shrew, and, yeah.
You know what, even in Relief Society, I think the story had that cast. Like, I remember this story not as being about Thomas Marsh and him leaving the church, but it being about, like, petty, squabbling, gossipy Relief Society bitches who have this little feud, right? And that the moral of the story is, you gossipy women, you know, don't get your feathers in all ruffled, because when you were the Relief Society midweek activity coordinator, you did it this way, and now they're doing it some other way. And it was like those kind of really superficial,
feminine,
catty, like girl problems that could drive people out of the church.
The moral of the story is, don't be a petty bitch. And the second moral of the story is, don't be loyal to your petty bitch wife.
Right.
Oh, so cheerful. It's almost as good as infant mortality. This is just a really a bright episode.
Yeah.
And it's about to get worse.
You know, we should know when to quit, like other people who have gone before us know how to quit. We really have gone past our expiration date with this whole podcasting thing.
I'm actually on the verge of getting the fuck out.
Are you?
Stop.
Yeah.
This is Randy's last episode again?
Yeah.
Randy's 17th last episode.
Oh.
So let me reread what Hinckley said. What a very small and trivial thing, a little cream over which two women quarreled, those petty bitches. But it led to, or at least was a factor in, Governor Boggs' cruel extermination order, which drove this. This is actually worse. This makes it worse, because he's basically saying this petty bitch caused the Hans Mill massacre.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
He's putting this on Thomas Marsh's wife, who do we ever get her name, by the way?
Or is she just Sister Marsh?
Yes,
I think I'm remembering a Sarah.
She's Sister Thomas B. Marsh.
Oh, his wife, Elizabeth.
Elizabeth, okay. But it led to, or at least was a factor in, Governor Boggs' cruel extermination order, which drove the Saints from the state of Missouri. With all the terrible suffering and consequent death that followed, the man who should have settled this quarrel, but who rather pursued it, lost his standing in the church. He lost his testimony of the gospel. Don't let that happen to you.
All right, well, I do want to talk just a little bit about the next one, which is being critical of leaders' imperfections, because the example they always give for this is Simon Ryder when he was getting a blessing his official commission to preach.
It's Simon's Ryder.
Simon's, oh, thank you, right.
Don't offend him from the grave.
Oh, damage. Right. So his name was spelled Rider with an I instead of Rider with a Y. And Simon's Rider thought if the spirit through which he had been called to preach could err in the matter of spelling his name, it might have erred in calling him to the ministry as well. Or in other words, he was led to doubt if he were called at all by the Spirit of God because of the error in spelling his name. So yeah, that is a stupid reason to leave the church if somebody misspells your name. But that's the example you get for being critical of leaders' imperfections. I mean, there's imperfections and there's imperfections. There's like grammar and spelling errors, and there's prophesying in the name of the Lord something that doesn't come true and falls apart within a month, bankrupting people.
Well, they even tip their hand on the last line. It says, Simon's writer later apostatized from the church. So my suspicion is that Simon's writer was annoyed that a revelation was published that had his name spelled wrong, but he was fine for a while. And then something else led to his apostasy, like the failing of the Kirtland Bank, anti-bank society or whatever it was.
Right, because after all, this is what the lesson is supposed to be about. The lesson claims to be about church history and why so many people apostatized from the church, without ever saying how many of Joseph Smith's prophecies not only didn't come to pass, but spectacularly failed in grand and glorious fashion, right?
Yeah, or like Independence, Missouri, like the bank. I want to actually do some research on Simon's writer.
Yeah, find out what happened, how he left the church.
Yeah, they actually further tip their hand with the question, what can we learn from this story? How does being critical of our church leaders make us more susceptible to deception? So they're even admitting in the question here that Simon's writer did not leave the church based on a misspelling. It just made him more susceptible to leave the church later.
Well, but they're making a statement in the form of a question, and they're telling everybody that being right. critical makes you susceptible to, you know, it makes you an easy target for Satan. So don't be critical.
But the narrative is that I was always taught is that he left the church because his name was spelled wrong. Yeah. Period.
Right.
That's obviously
nitpicky. Not the case. It's nitpicky.
Well, yeah, and growing up in the church, I was always taught that the issue people had with Joseph Smith was that maybe he was too rowdy. That's what people didn't like about him, mm-hmm. you know, without being told that he coerced dozens of women into marrying him by saying they'd be destroyed if they didn't, or promising their family exaltation if they did, and that some of them were underage. I mean, told none of those things that people might be critical of, just told that maybe he was too rowdy.
Yeah, that was a Truman Madsen thing in the Joseph Smith tapes, that the lectures that Truman Madsen did.
You're right.
They painted Joseph Smith as the uncouth, country,
fun-loving guy. He was just a fun-loving guy.
Yeah, like at
he liked
one
to
minister
wrestle with kids.
Came.
Yeah.
So he tells a story in those tapes of a Protestant minister and his wife came to visit Joseph Smith because they were interested in converting. And when they arrived, he was wrestling in the front yard, and they were so offended that. How could a prophet of God be acting in such an improper, inappropriate manner by wrestling? Oh, and so they paint Joseph as just this superhero that, you know, is a regular guy that you can relate to and love, and he would play sticks with you. And
again, it's those Protestant investigators' fault for being so easily offended and petty
and easily deceived by Satan.
Yeah.
It's actually starting to really piss me off how far from what actually happened these narratives and these stories we're given are. And it really is helping me see why I thought and why so many people think that people only leave the church over stupid shit, because it's all about, you know, petty arguments and misspelling of names and the prophet being too rowdy and not being presidential and not having the temperament to be president of the church. When actually there's like so many serious reasons for people to have issues with Joseph Smith and his teachings and character.
Yeah, you say serious, but it's not pertinent to your salvation. That's the phrase that you hear all the time. Those things aren't pertinent to the to our salvation, and it goes right into, you know, we'll get answers someday. The only thing that we really need to know is that if we have faith in our leaders and we do everything that they say and we get the saving ordinances, we'll be good.
All right, how are we going to wrap this up here, folks? Let's buzz through the rest. So being offended, we covered. Again, somebody didn't get a seat in the temple, and that's why they left the church, not because they lost all this money. Rationalizing disobedience, Randy talked about that. That was his main reason for leaving the church, is because he wanted to sin.
Absolutely.
Accepting the false teachings of the world, the evil world. I love it when the world is like in capital letters and it's a cruel character with devious cackle. But what I love about this. Go ahead.
It's always better to be general when you're talking about the world.
Yeah.
All just encompassing. Leave it as
a boogeyman, the world. But the false teachings of the world is that it's fashionable to lie and cheat. What? Who's ever said it's fashionable to lie and cheat? Oh, and pornography, of course. And pornography is awesome.
Yeah, and there's also code words in here. Immorality is acceptable. What does that mean? Homosexuality is acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right, so those are the reasons that people leave the church. Okay, that you're taught as a Mormon in Sunday school. The reasons that people actually leave the church, 3/4 of the people leave the church. Sorry, this is the scariest reason, because they don't believe it's true. Sorry, that's why. That's why we don't go to church. If we believed it's true, we'd go.
Yeah, it's almost like in this quote by H. David Burton, Bishop, General Bishop, is that you become nihilistic. He says, one of Satan's insidious strategies is to progressively soften our senses regarding what is right and wrong. And what's the Mormon epistemology? What is right and wrong?
What's Glenn? Right?
What is right and wrong, Glenn?
What do you mean? Anything that's right comes of God, everything that's wrong comes of the devil? Is that what you're going for?
No. Whatever the brethren say is right, and whatever they say is wrong.
Okay. All right. Ask me again.
what is the epistemology of a Mormon on determining what is right and what is wrong?
I don't know. What are you going for the...
Oh, Jesus Christ. Why'd you ask me?
You're not head of the Sunday school class anymore, Glenn.
Yeah.
Did you ever get people that ask you leading questions in Sunday school?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
And you also... Come on, Glenn. I thought you would have flexed again on this one. Flex, flex, flex.
Flex? No.
I like this line. Satan constantly bombards us with deceptive propaganda, desirably packaged and carefully disguised. In other words, these arguments you're going to hear from the world are going to really make sense. And you can't be fooled by things that make sense. In my opinion, what they're fighting here is when they were fighting against gay marriage, they didn't have a really cogent argument against it. It really basically just boiled down to God. This is what God has declared. And we, as your prophets, seers, and revelators, so declare it. Because there really wasn't, when you look at the Prop 8 appeal transcripts, they didn't even really try to defend it in the court of law. Because they had no defense, they had no research, they had no evidence, they had no logical argument. And I just think that what they're saying is what is deceptive is code for convincing. You're going to hear some convincing arguments from outside the church that what we're saying is wrong, but you need to understand that that is Satan deceiving you. And so yes. now they're insulating them from convincing, compelling, evidence-based arguments.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, I think that's significant because it poisons every interaction that I've ever had with true believers regarding gay marriage.
I hope that our few remaining friends give up on trying to save us. I hope we come up with a fail-safe plot to piss off the dumb few that forgave us. I hope the fences we mended fall down beneath their own weight. And I hope we hang on past the last exit. I hope it's already too late. And I hope the junkyard a few blocks from here someday burns down. And I hope the rising black smoke carries me far away. And I never come back to this town again.
Hi, this is Skyler from West Haven, Utah. And I have met several prophets through my life. Oh, and did I mention I've seen Jesus? I can't count the number of times I met that guy. I've also met Elijah once. Oh, did I mention I work in a hospital psychiatric unit? You can comment on this episode on the website, infantsonthrones.com. And if you really like what you hear, give the Quorum a 5-star rating and write a short review on iTunes. I did. Anyone for the closing prayer?
I hope I cut myself shaving tomorrow. I hope it bleeds all day long. Our friends say it's darkest before the sun rises. We're pretty sure they're all wrong. I hope it stays dark forever. I hope the worst isn't over. And I hope you blink before I do. And I hope I never get sober. And I hope when you think of me years down the line, you can't find one good thing to say. And I'd hope that if I found the strength to walk out, you'd stay the hell out of my way. I am drowning. There is no sign of land. You are coming down with me, hand in unlovable hand. And I hope you die. I hope we both die.
Okay.
Who wants to read first?
Welcome back to another episode of Mormon Expression.
GTFO.
Yeah.
Know when to quit.
Yeah.
All right.
Know how to quit. Know when to quit and then come back and then quit and then come back and then quit and then come back. Yeah.
That's why
John Larson knows how to quit. He's got a lot of practice at it.
Ooh, burn.
Burn.
and then throw everything behind a paywall.
Yeah, right. Then take your ball and go home. Oh, jeez.
Oh, John Larson, what an example.
Yeah. Thank you for listening to Infants on Thrones.